This is SaaS Scaled, the podcast where data meets action with host Armon Shrocky. Each week, Armon will be sitting down with CEOs and industry leaders from the technology sector, giving you the insight to innovate without reinventing the wheel. They'll discuss challenges, best practices, and how to identify the right metrics. So if you want to get to market faster and in a way that matters, then subscribe and join us every week as we discuss SaaS Scale. This episode is brought to you by Curvey, the modern no-code analytics solution, the tools you need to take action with your data on a platform built for maximum scalability, security, and cost efficiencies. If you're ready to reduce complexity and dramatically lower costs, then contact us today at curvey.com. That's Q-R-V-E-Y.com.
Welcome to another episode of SaaS Scaled. This week, I'm with a guest from, well, he lives in Canada, but the company is in Silicon Valley, and he travels very often between these two locations of the company, Mark Walker at New. And I will let him to introduce himself and tell us a little bit about the company. And we get into some very interesting topics this episode.
Hey, Armon, thank you so much for having me. New's a great and really interesting company. I didn't found it. Very unusually, I was a recruited CEO into a series seed company, which doesn't really happen very often. Mm-hmm. And the company was founded by an amazing woman named Tina Kung, ex-Oracle, ex-Salesforce, ex-Zora, a real quote-to-cash expert. And she had understood or realized that a change needed to happen in business systems to facilitate the pace of change that we're dealing with now. Very prescient. And some VCs came to me and they said, "Hey, Mark, would you like to be a CEO again?" I'm like, "No, I really want to go kiteboarding." But then they introduced me to Tina, and then Tina asked me to be the CEO. And my first reaction was, "Why aren't you the CEO?" And she explained how big the product was. And then it's been a great pleasure for me to work with her and the amazing team we built together. And now we provide, quoting, self-service, billing infrastructure for some of the largest, all the largest AI companies on earth, maybe with the exception of Cohere, and many, many, many other companies.
Fantastic. That's great. Now, when we spoke briefly before this recording, you mentioned a point that was very fascinating to me, and you said the kind of things have changed in the way that expertise is easier now to gain, and experience still takes time. But can you expand upon that point a little bit?
Right. So the phrase I think I used was that expertise is dead, but experience isn't.
Okay, good.
And what I mean by that, obviously, when you make something pithy, you're exaggerating. Because obviously, juggling isn't dead. There's definitely things that people know how to do that are hard to communicate to others, right? There's sort of an instinctive knowledge. But there's not a lot of that the large language models, particularly the specialized implementations of large language models, think of the coding platforms, they actually do have embedded in them a huge amount of expertise. And what this means is that if you think your job is putting fingers on keys, that's over. Or if you think your job is, well, not the putting fingers on keys is over, but if you think the anchoring of your job, that's probably over. But if you think that your job is deciding whether to put the fingers on the keys or what the fingers on the keys should be doing, which is mostly what engineering is, it's never really typing, right? Then that is still really important. And so what that means is, and what we're seeing is that maybe the best people to design your software are not computer science graduates. It's not that the computer science graduates have no role, they do, and it's not that some of the people who'd be amazing aren't computer science graduates. It's just that there are some people who can understand problems really, really well and articulate them really, really well. And all of a sudden, they can instantiate results very, very quickly. So the first place I think we're going to see this is in the implementation of complex systems, where the person who understands the business process will be able to move it forward quickly. But the next place we're going to see it, and we're starting to see it, is in actually product managers who can develop features very, very quickly. And I think that's a massive change. Like, that is speed-wise, that's a massive change. I think conceptually, that's a massive change.
Amazing. And how do you see the difference between last few years and 20 years ago? Some, you know, what is the change? Many people may answer that question by saying that, well, we didn't have AI at this scale implemented. Now we have AI. Your answer might be different, a little bit looking at the bigger picture. How would you say now is different than before?
Yeah, so I think the way we talk about it new, and we're talking about it with our customers, and we have the great honor of being able to talk about this with the people who are causing the change to happen, right? Is that the pace of change of the pace of change has changed, right? Mm-hmm. And you can almost write this as math. In fact, we have a t-shirt. You can get it at new.io/change. And it's a t-shirt that basically has this as math and then the words on the back. And we think it's a very, very important idea to understand. So it's not that things are going faster. It's always been that things were going faster. Moore's Law, it's always been going faster, right? But there are moments in history when all of a sudden things start going faster in more ways than they ever went faster before. And I think the greatest analogy between what is happening now and what's happened before, we actually have to go back half a millennia to the Gutenberg moment, when the printing press becomes available all across Europe and eventually all across the world. And that causes an explosion that is different in kind. It ends a civilization, right? People sort of think that we have this continuous thread. No, Gutenberg comes out, we have radical, radical, radical change, because all of a sudden now we could communicate more ideas in more ways, more people doing more things at more speed. You know, before I used to write out books, right, by hand.
Exactly.
And that acceleration between the time it would take to write, to reproduce a book by hand, right, and the time it would take to print tens of thousands of books is the kind of moment that we're at. And so I don't think people really appreciate how big of a change that is. They think, so, oh, we got ChatGPT now. It's like, that's not what's happening, right? What we have is a system of communicating information that is semi and rapidly approaching autonomous, semi-autonomous and becoming autonomous. And that's going to be a drastic change and very exciting.
Yeah, that's very interesting. The kind of the way you explained it and the way I understand it is what happened in the past is knowledge were kind of democratized, meaning that you could print the book now at a faster pace rather than writing it down, and it takes sometimes, you know, month to really write down the whole book. And even accuracy of it is a question, because many people in the history, actually they memorized the book and then mm-hmm. they went back and then started writing the book from the mm-hmm. memory. And that changed. And now knowledge, you know, at that point, knowledge started to be democratized and be more available. And now with this new technology we have, expertise is getting democratized. And now people actually can really distribute expertise much faster than ever before, rather than waiting for years to gain it and then apply it.
Yeah, I have an investment in a startup, algorithmic trading startup, a really fascinating company. And it has two employees and has built an entire like regulated industry trading system, right? Now, it's not going to stay with two employees, but the point was their MVP is the final product. Like, it's just an incredible acceleration. I think if you go back, remember the SaaS explosion of SaaS, the dynamic part of that wasn't that all of a sudden you could rent software, right? you could always rent software. That was actually a big part of IBM's business model forever, right? It's now that you could access powerful applications without capital. So when you raise money, what you didn't have to do was raise money for the servers. You didn't have to raise money for the networking. You didn't have to raise money for the infrastructure and the cooling and all the other things that would take historically to put together a large company. You could actually incrementally expand your footprint. And obviously this got better and better over time, but there was sort of a sea change in sort of like 1999, 2000, that was kind of over by 2006, 2007, when everything went from nobody had ever rented software to everybody's renting everything, right? It's all subscription based by 2007, 2008. That's the sort of change that's happening now. In other words, it doesn't mean that the old models completely went away. It's not that on-premise software completely disappeared or anything like that. It's that the pricing model, the way you price things, that radically changed and never went back. And I think we're going to see that happen in the next 2 years. The other big difference is that took almost a decade for that to happen. This is happening incredibly quickly. Like, it'll be substantially over in the next 2 years. Right? So 4 years.
No. That's great. And now from SaaS perspective, if you look at the SaaS business model, not from companies and from customers' perspective looking at SaaS, from their perspective, this is a software I subscribe when I need it and I use it. But from SaaS vendors or SaaS companies' perspective, that I'm a founder, I have a SaaS company, I'm CEO of a SaaS company, I'm one of the leaders of these SaaS companies, and now I want to serve the market. Now, some people say that, you know, AI apps are different than SaaS applications, because when you are building the kind of AI company, your IP is actually the model that you have trained more than it is the software that you have written. When you have a SaaS company, the IP and the value is more in the kind of algorithms, maybe in the kind of the code that you have developed. And over time, more AI companies are going to be available and doing exactly serving the same purpose that SaaS companies have been created to accomplish. And it will be gradually replacing, you know, the SaaS. So more AI apps will be available serving the same purpose by actually putting the model there rather than really the software that is fully coded to serve that purpose. And every time you want to upgrade the software, software developers have to improve their code. How do you see that from your perspective?
Hey, that's a huge question, Arman. Okay, so let's break it down into some pieces, right? I think when people say that it's not the software anymore, it's the model, it depends on the type of AI product you're developing, whether that's true. So, for example, one of our customers, Thought Exchange, does essentially a new form of survey, right? Where you're gathering information at a much more granular level. And for them, for Thought Exchange, it really is, the second part is true. Like, it's not that their software is not useful, but the way in which they're leveraging AI is unique, and the way they train their systems to work is unique. And therefore, the substantive portion of value is in the AI itself, right? In the model itself. And you could actually deliver that experience through many, many, many different interfaces. In fact, they do, right? Many, many appropriate to certain circumstances, and produce a great outcome, right? By way of contrast, we can look at New, right? And so New is about to release our MCP server and all of the agentic capabilities, but we're a transactional system. So we are, you know, quoting and self-service and billing in one system. And so the agentic interactions that we're going to have are independent of the model that we're working with. So when we release this, of course, since we have the major AI companies as customers, we're not going to pick winners and losers. And so you could be able to use any of the major models, including people who aren't our customers, frankly. And in fact, bring your own account to the party, because there's huge data security issues around these transactional data. Like, for example, the obvious would be, like, I don't think Anthropic would want OpenAI to be able to see their customer data, right? That would not be a good thing. I don't think that these companies are very ethical. I don't think they'd be doing that, but I think they would want to keep it in their own account. But other customers would want to do that as well, right? So in our case, the software and the data model is actually the defensible portion of it. The AI is actually interchangeable, right? Mm-hmm. And so for some customers, you know, one AI may work better for their use case, or even for some use cases, one AI would work better. And I think both things are true. I think that I had a really interesting conversation with Tal Broda a little while ago, and we were talking about this issue, and I can't go into specifically what we're talking about, but we were talking about the distinction between, or the edges of programmatic or deterministic, sometimes we call deterministic software, and probabilistic or AI-based software, and where these two things will meet. And while I don't want to talk about what we talked about, that distinction is exactly what I was just talking about, that there are certain things that deterministic or programmatic software will just be better at, and the data model and the infrastructure for doing that will be defensible, and there'll be certain things where it's just not better at. Like, so for example, deterministically reading a contract is not doable or defensible. But the interface that allows somebody to consume the outcome of an AI consumption of a contract, which some of our customers in fact do, those interfaces are incredibly important if you believe that human beings will still need to read contracts or get contracts summarized. That was a bit long-winded, but I hope it was helpful.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And thank you very much for the explanation. It makes perfect sense to me. Now, we are at this age, you know, we talked about SaaS, we talked about the new age acceleration that is in place. Things are moving forward. Someone told me in this podcast that, you know, people tend to probably, we as people, we tend to underestimate the long-term impact of any new technology, but we tend to probably, you know, overestimate the impact of the technology in short term. And some people, you know, normally, you know, may look at the changes at Gen AI today and overestimate the impact in the next 2 years, but underestimate the impact in the 10, 15 years. The same thing we did with mobile, the same thing we did with cloud, the same thing we did with internet and any other technology we can think of. So that's definitely, you know, interesting. And when I look back and see, okay, let's say this is back to the day that iPhone was introduced as the real smartphone.
I was just thinking about that. Right. I was just thinking. Yeah, that's exactly what you made me think about. I was thinking about Palm Pilot to BlackBerry to iPhone, or BlackBerry to Palm Pilot to iPhone, or whatever the order of operations was. Yeah,
exactly. And when I say iPhone, I mean probably the second year of iPhone when apps or app market was introduced. That's really the real revolution, that people could really develop apps and put it on iPhone. And then these apps opened tons of opportunities and created tons of use cases. And then, of course, followed by Android and the same thing, and app market and marketplace and these kind of things. So definitely that's something that, you know, it started after that phase, not the day maybe that iPhone was introduced, but the day that actually the app market was introduced and people started writing it. And you talked about MCP, for example, as a protocol that allows these kind of, you know, AI engines to maybe interact with each other, or maybe interact with other applications, and other applications that are MCP certified, that they can interact and be open to the AI engine to be more effective and easier, rather than writing the integration one at a time. And, you know, that will take forever to do that and keep them up to date. So all of those are kind of leading us to the age that maybe the new app market for AI is being created at one point, and that will be the start of real impact that we are going to see. And you know, in that case, it's much easier for people to really come in and all parties participate, not just a few companies, but everybody can participate to really get that going and starting to make big changes happen.
Yeah, I think that's very prescient. I think you're absolutely right. And I think there's a major economic driver that will cause that to happen. And there's a huge pricing problem in AI, particularly in the model vendors, but it also affects some other companies as well, that never really happened before in software, or it happened so slowly that nobody ever paid attention to it, right? And that is the deflationary impact of model improvements. So imagine that somebody committed to spend $1 million on some AI technology. Well, the cost of delivering that $1 million is going down like incredibly quickly. Say it was 1 million credits. Let's say 1 million credits just to make it simple, right? So 1 million tokens or 1 million credits. And the cost of delivering a token is going through the floor, right? Now, it's paradoxical because actually companies are spending billions and billions and billions of dollars. So the cost of having the tokens that you would want to buy is going up, but the cost of delivering the tokens that you actually sell is going down like incredibly quickly. So what that means is that when somebody commits $1 million to buy 1 million tokens, that $1 million will actually buy more than 1 million tokens. Let's say 2 million tokens. Well, if you're trying to project your sales revenue in that world, and this, of course, will cascade out into the apps as well, because the cost of cost of the tokens goes down, the cost of delivering your results goes down, and because competition is ruthless, right? That means that your new entrant, if a new entrant enters the market and they have a comparable technology that is half as expensive. So imagine if all of a sudden somebody comes along with a cursor, that's something to imagine it. This happens every day. Somebody comes along with a cursor competitor that now costs half as much as cursor. You better have focused on having capabilities and capabilities in your product that makes the organizational change of switching high enough that nobody actually pays attention to that. But even if you do that, the price pressure for new customers will cause your pricing to go down, which will effectively your other customers. Very, very interesting. It's something that the chip manufacturers and the device manufacturers have been dealing with the exception of Apple, right? But normally handset manufacturers, computer manufacturers, and chip manufacturers have been dealing with Moore's Law forever, but on like decade-long timescales, right? These are on like 3 week or 3 month timescales. And I think that's something we haven't grappled with before. It's super interesting. So I think what's going to happen is that large AI companies are going to start taking a page out of Amazon's book, where you see an environment where compute on Amazon is also under that kind of negative pressure. And they are basically, you're going to be able to buy, I would predict that within a year, somebody's going to start offering it the reverse of what we're doing. In the same way as we can say, hey, you can buy any model and use it with new. It's going to be, hey, you can do your spend on any of the apps that are certified to work with our models, right? And we can imagine that the person who's already got the infrastructure to do this is Google, right? They already are in this market. They already have the App Store environment. I'm not saying they're the only people, but you can imagine that lots of other people will do it too. I can imagine Microsoft jumping in there and starting to offer this sort of thing. And of course, Apple can do this as well, right? But it's not that they're the only people who can do it. That technology is not hard, right? So what'll happen is everybody will do it, and then it'll be choosing the app environment that makes your AI purchase super valuable. I think that's going to be a big thing.
Fantastic. Very insightful. And I love the points that you are making on this kind of fronts. That's very helpful. At least I'm learning a lot. Hope the audience will feel the same. But I'm going to change gears at this point and ask you a fun question. So totally irrelevant to what we discussed, but something that, you know, you might have a good answer for it. And if you had to pick a city to go at any time of the year, and you can choose the time yourself and say, okay, for this time of the year, I'm going to spend a month or 2 weeks in this particular city, anywhere in the world, what would be that kind of city that you would spend a few weeks there?
I mean, obviously, one of the trade-offs of being a serial tech executive is you don't necessarily have enough time to go to all the cities. So there's all sorts of cities that I haven't been to that I would love to go to, you know. And but of the cities that I have been to, the most unusually amazing place that I think most people haven't been to, like Rio's amazing, but everybody kind of knows it's amazing, right? Vancouver's amazing and everybody knows it's amazing. San Francisco's amazing, everybody knows it's amazing. Paris, London, you can keep going, right? Montevideo, Uruguay, it's like Paris in the middle of South America. It's like the leafy street part of Paris in the middle of South America, warm, friendly, very, very friendly population. Amazing asado, like social life. But you know, you go to Europe and you think, oh, I'm going to go stay somewhere and I'll go to the cafe. And after a couple of days, I'll notice I'm coming and every day, and they'll say hi to me, which never freaking happens, right? Because they don't really want you there. In Uruguay, people literally will come up to you and go, oh, wow, you're not from here. Where are you from? Oh, you're from Canada. What made you come to Uruguay? And so a very friendly place and, you know, full of a lot of like super chill, you know, super chill Argentinians and Uruguayans. And then you've got all of Punta del Este and Jose Ignacio, the beach towns, La Barra, all up the coast of Uruguay towards Brazil. And of course, if you want to get on a boat, you can go to Buenos Aires in like 2 hours, right? Or get on a plane, you can do it in an hour, but it's just as fast to take the boat. So I would say Montevideo, if it's not on your bucket list, you should definitely go to Montevideo.
Yep, I just added that. So definitely I will check it out in the next few years. Now, my last question to you is about really a book that maybe you liked and you wanted to introduce to others, either personally you liked it or professionally. If you can share it with the audience.
Yeah, I think the business book that has had the biggest impact on me and that I think about a lot, I think about it in the middle of conversations that I'm having with people, particularly hard conversations I'm having with people, is Multipliers by Liz Wiseman. It's about the nature of empowering leadership. And I think we can all think of people we've dealt with who are like, no, you're doing it wrong. You're doing it this way. You need to do it. We're going to do this, then we're going to do this, then we're going to do this, then we're going to do this. Or even, I tell you, do something different than that, but I just yell it at you, right? And she talks about how that is fundamentally diminishing. And yet the most powerful leaders are the leaders who say, who draw out or you know, yeah, that's really good. Have you thought about doing it this way? And just basically she's pointing out that what makes companies go faster is in fact the creativity of the people in the company. But every time you tell somebody what to do, and obviously sometimes you have to tell them what to do, so there's ways of doing that that doesn't diminish them as a person, that's very powerful. And it may sound a little airy-fairy, like a little bit woo-hoo. It's not at all. It's not a woo-hoo book at all. It's very, very practical advice, particularly if you're a first-time manager. But also, I was handed it by my COO in my last company before New, in a very, very stressful time when I basically was not being a good leader. And my COO, who's a great guy named Yasu Fujita, he walked up to me and he goes, Mark, you need to read at least the first two chapters of this book. And he goes, so you're going to break everybody. Like, yes, you know, yes, you're a super smart guy. And yes, you're super driven to make this company succeed. And we're all behind you, but you need to read this book. And I did. It was so important to me that I kept it on my bedside table. So when I woke up every morning, I looked at it. And then we went through other hard times and great times together. But I still think that's the most powerful book.
Fantastic. I appreciate it. Again, it was a pleasure having you on this podcast, Mark. Thank you very much for joining us.
Armin, thank you so much for inviting me. I enjoyed it immensely.
Thank you for listening to SaaS Scaled with Armon Ashraghi. For show notes and any resources mentioned in today's episode, go to saasscaled.com. If you're enjoying our show, give us a 5-star review and share on LinkedIn. and be sure to subscribe for any updates on future episodes. Thanks for listening. This episode is brought to you by Curve, the modern no-code analytics solution, the tools you need to take action with your data on a platform built for maximum scalability, security, and cost efficiencies. If you're ready to reduce complexity and dramatically lower costs, then contact us today at curvey.com. That's Q-R-V-E-Y.com.